This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser. Every day we're bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance, plus technology, politics, so much going on in the world of politics, economics, and it's all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors. You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio. And be sure to watch us, too, on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News. So, Paul, remember how yesterday, I can't remember what story we were talking about. Was it a hedge fund story or something? And and about, you know, there's certain things you put in, like, a headline on the Bloomberg. Yes. And often it has to do with hedge funds or bonuses.
Yep.
And, like, it tends to trend really high among the most read.
We get what we call read spikes.
Yeah, totally, right? Well, this is one of them.
Yes.
And the headline on it is, Wall Street traders to take home a smaller slice in a banner year. And our own Jenny Serain wrote it. She's Bloomberg News finance reporter, and she joins us on the phone. Jenny, I want to know, you know, what's going on? And I'm curious how small, because I always feel like when you're talking Wall Street, it's still kind of large by most people's, you know, estimations.
Yes, that's very important context definitely to include. I think the main metrics that we've been looking at this week is just how much of this huge gain in revenue are traders really going to be able to take home. And it looks like so far the amount that banks are setting aside is just less than what they maybe set aside last year. But your point, Carol, these traders and investment bankers, they make far more money, actually about five times as much money as other private sector employees in the city. So, you know, their average salary is somewhere in the neighborhood of $400,000. Their average bonuses are somewhere in the neighborhood of $150,000. And so they're just averages. So there's folks out there that make way more than that. So definitely runs the gamut. But, you know, even though they've produced these really solid results, really help prop up their banks, they are taking home that smaller slice.
Paul, you're someone who understands this world really well. Isn't that kind of weird?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'll say, Carol, is what's most important, obviously, is the actual total dollars you bring home, you know, having spent more than 20 years on Wall Street. But that compensation ratio, and Jenny's got some great numbers in here, you know, Morgan Stanley, 36%, Goldman Sachs, 33%. In my day, back in the day, which wasn't that long ago, it was closer to 50%, 50.
Wow.
That's when Wall Street was a good game. Now it's just a game. Jenny, is there a sense here that there's any turnover risk on Wall Street from some of these ratios coming down, or just given the world we're in, the management feels pretty comfortable?
No, I think it was actually something that Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon raised. He said, you know, obviously other parts of the bank are suffering, and so we have to kind of keep in mind the fact that we had to set aside billions in provisions for credit losses and things like that. But that retention risk is real, and we can't lose our good talent in a year where they've produced these really solid results for us. And so he was really saying, you know, we are keeping a lot of our philosophy the same, but they do have, you know, when profits sag over 30%, they can't just ignore that. And so that's probably a little bit of what you're seeing with these ratios coming down.
So what does it mean in terms of potentially losing talent? Or is it not enough of a change that we're going to see a lot of, you know, people moving some firms to go to another firm?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see kind of where we net out. You know, obviously the fourth quarter is the big kind of where the rubber meets the road when it comes to these decisions. So it'll be interesting to see where we net out. And I also think the other weird part of all of this is that it's an election year. And so you've got politicians on both sides of the aisle that have been known to, you know, beat up on banker bonuses from time to time. And so I think there's a lot of pressure on the banks to keep those ratios low. However, they also know that this is a real risk, and that, you know, especially in a year where you've got desks producing record results, that they could easily find another job, and they don't want to see that happen. So I think it's a tightrope for them to walk, for sure.
So, Jenny, there's another story on the Bloomberg terminal saying that could be a banner. This is going to be a banner year for Wall Street trading, maybe $100 billion in revenue here. When I was on Wall Street, there was, you know, big disparity between, you know, the big whale traders and then the junior folks. Is that still the case, or is it much more of a tighter band these days to try to rein in some of those star traders that could really set you back in terms of compensation?
I still think there's a few star traders out there. I mean, I'm sure on the whole, yeah, they've tried to rein it in, and I think they definitely learned their lessons. in the last crisis, you know, getting called vampire squids and the like. So they they like to avoid that at all costs. But there's definitely still traders out there that are, I mean, you know, based on the results they bring in, they're bringing in big bonuses as well. And so I think while they've definitely learned their lesson and have this real eye towards compensation, they're also still very aware that these guys could easily leave banking and go to the hedge funds or you know, go to a competitor, and they don't want to be ever trading against them. So it's definitely a weird little line for them to walk.
That 2010 Rolling Stone story about Wall Street, and, you know, the great the vampire squids, man, that's like it's just a great Trivial Pursuit question. It is interesting, though. You know, you feel like, Jenny, like, you know, things have definitely changed from the financial crisis. So it's interesting, though, to see, and I feel like bonuses, we learned a lot, right, coming off of the crisis about what that means in terms of compensation. But it is surprising when you're looking at, as Paul mentioned, a banner year, and as you report, and yet it's being squeezed. It just, to me, doesn't quite make sense.
Well, I think a lot of traders would agree with you. And I guess
surprise.
Well, David Solomon actually talked about this week, too. He was like, you know, in a normal year where we don't have to set aside a ton of provisions and therefore our profit isn't, you know, totally zapped by that, we don't really think about, you know, that's not as much of a consideration. But because that's the environment we're in and the world we're living in, like, it has to be part of our considerations as we're making these compensation decisions. And so I hadn't, I guess, really thought about it that way until you mentioned that this week. And I think it's a good point that, you know, for a lot of years, traders can probably you know, squeak by without really thinking about the broader profitability of the bank. But, you know, this is the year where everyone's worried about credit and what that's going to look like. So it has to be kind of considered.
Yeah, it's just another uncertainty that everybody has to think about. All right, Jenny Serain, thank you so much. As we mentioned, this is among our most read stories on the Bloomberg. If you want to read the whole thing, just go to Bloomberg.com. Jenny Serain, Bloomberg News finance reporter, joining us on the phone.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser on Bloomberg Radio.
We've got to do our daily check on the virus. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on, and we all are watching some of those numbers increasingly go up. We're definitely seeing it overseas, but it's also happening here. Although New York seems to be settling down, which is a really, really good thing. We'll get to that in just a moment. Let's get back to your top business headlines, though. Check in with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much. Let's get right to the numbers. Off-session lows, the S&P's down 10, dropped now of 0.3%, have been down 1.4%. The Dow tumbling 25, down 0.1%. The Dow have been down 1.2%. And NASDAQ down 89 now, a drop of 0.8%. 10-year yield 0.72%, gold up 0.2%, up $4 the ounce at $19.05, and West Texas Intermediate crude down 0.3%, $40.90 a barrel on WTI. Stocks lower across the board, Europe's biggest cities clamping down to curb the coronavirus, adding to concern that further restrictions could cause more economic damage. Ricardo Salinas Pliego, the head of Grupo Salinas and Latin America's seventh richest man, took to Twitter yesterday to confirm his COVID-19 diagnosis and said, quote, everyone will get the infection eventually. London and Paris, meanwhile, clamping down on gatherings. France reporting a record 30,621 new positive test results. FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn says a series of trial stops involving Eli Lilly, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca are all a part of the system to make sure that any COVID-19 vaccine or therapy will ultimately be safe. Dr. William Moss is Executive Director of the Johns Hopkins International Vaccine Access Center, and on Bloomberg Television this morning, he talked about the coronavirus vaccine development process.
We're looking to compare how many people get COVID in those who get the vaccine and how many people get COVID who don't get the study vaccine. And in a pandemic, because there are a lot of cases, this can happen much more quickly than outside a pandemic. So this whole process of vaccine development can be accelerated and really be done safely as well.
The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Peloton Interactive has been sued for patent infringement by Icon Health and Fitness, that's the maker of the Nordic track bike, escalating the legal tussle between the two fitness equipment giants, shares up by 2.8%. Fiat Chrysler has agreed to invest as much as $1.1 billion in one of its two assembly plants in Canada, all part of a tentative agreement reached with more than 9,000 local auto workers. Fiat Chrysler shares tumbling now by just about 1.4%. Recapping, stocks lower. S&P down now by 10, down 0.3%. I'm Charlie Pellett. That's the Bloomberg Business Flash.
All right, Charlie, appreciate that update. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Paul Sweeney on this Thursday. A lot of headlines when it comes to the virus. We've got more curbs imposed because of COVID over in the UK, France as well. European nations are seeing record increases in new infections. So we're dealing with that. We're also seeing, though, some better news maybe in New York City, a leveling off of infections in some of those hot spots. But that's not the case if you take a look at a city like Houston. They are dealing with some troubling numbers. So let's bring in our own Michelle Cortez, because she is Bloomberg News health science and medical technology reporter, and she joins us on the phone from Minneapolis. Michelle, always good to check in with you and just kind of see where we are. So among the headlines, you know, when it comes to COVID, whether it's the vaccine, treatments, just the rising numbers, and then let's not forget that we're also seeing the Harris campaign yeah, specifically now deal with an outbreak. What is it that's catching your attention that you think everybody needs to kind of sit up and take notice about?
The number of infections is on the rise in Europe and some other places. We are hitting record levels for the pandemic. We always did know that this winter was going to be more difficult, but it's not yet winter, right? I mean, we're only the middle of October. So the idea that we are starting to see some really troubling things at a time when we should have learned some of our lessons in terms of how to behave individually to reduce the risk, and that we're seeing it now when there is still the option of, you know, being outside as opposed to inside, keeping your distance, wearing a mask, and we're seeing these rising numbers, I think that's very worrisome.
You know, Michelle, I guess the question is, as I look at those numbers coming out of Europe and other places, again, yes, we did expect some type of second wave. Is it just simply behavior issues, or is there potentially a new virus out there? I mean, a new strain of the virus, or is it just behavior?
So, I mean, that's the terrifying question, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is very, very worrisome. Like, I don't even want you to say that. Like, don't jinx anything, for heaven's sake. But that's the concern. I think that if that was actually happening, we would be seeing even much more dramatic numbers than we're seeing now. And I certainly hope that that's not the case. I have not heard anything about that. So,
fingers crossed.
I hope that. Yeah, fingers crossed. The things to remember is that it's not just our individual behavior. This is a respiratory virus. Respiratory viruses are known to circulate in the colder months. We're coming into the colder months. It also is known to circulate easier in dry, cold air conditions, air conditions,
yeah,
right, where there's less moisture in the air so that the viral particles can spread. They can basically last a little bit longer in the air and go from one person to another. So all of those things are conspiring against us right now. The thing is that it's so early days.
Yeah. Well, listen, Michelle, you know this, you know, you've been reporting for Bloomberg, you know, day in and day out, watching all of the developments. I mean, what are your expectations for as it starts to get even colder here? I mean, it's interesting to see New York kind of leveling off. And I do feel like this is a city that understands, here's what we need to do, folks. And I feel like everybody's getting used to wearing masks, and we get it, right? Some of us have been back to work, and we understand this social distancing thing, and we don't even think twice about it. But I do wonder what your expectations are.
It's really interesting if you look at the numbers. On Bloomberg.com, we have a really great map that you can look at individual states and see what's happening with the trends. And it really seems to me that the states that were hard hit early do seem to have come down and have kept things down. The increasing numbers that we're seeing in the U.S. and perhaps across Europe, there's not as good of of mapping data that I've seen out of there with these kind of great tracking numbers. The places that have just continually risen, you know, certainly we're seeing some of it in the Midwest and the Dakotas, that kind of stuff.
Right.
They're just on an upward trajectory. So they haven't yet basically embraced the suck, so to speak, right?
Like, yep,
you guys know how it's going to be in New York, and
yeah,
you know, you've reined it in. In other places, that's not yet happened, and hopefully we do get there. The other piece of it is that in New York, it was so intense.
Yeah, exactly.
In March and April. Now it seems like it's worse. The numbers are much higher, but it's spread out across an entire country as opposed to, you know, Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. Everything's crossed right now because we really hope it doesn't go back. Michelle, thank you so much. You're always keeping us up to date and just making us smarter. Michelle Cortez, Bloomberg News health science and medical technology reporter, on the phone from Minneapolis. We've got to do our daily check on the virus. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff going on, and we all are watching some of those numbers increasingly go up. We're definitely seeing it overseas, but it's also happening here. Although New York seems to be settling down, which is a really, really good thing. We'll get to that in just a moment. Let's get back to your top business headlines, though. Check in with Charlie Powell.
Hi, thank you very much. Let's get right to the numbers. Off-session lows, the S&P's down 10, dropped now of 0.3%, have been down 1.4%. The Dow tumbling 25, down 0.1%. The Dow have been down 1.2%. And NASDAQ down 89 now, a drop of 0.8%. 10-year 30-second 10-year yield 0.72%. Gold up 0.2%, up $4 the ounce at $19.05. And West Texas Intermediate crude down 0.3%, $40.90 a barrel on WTI. Stocks lower across the board. Europe's biggest cities clamping down to curb the coronavirus, adding to concern that further restrictions could cause more economic damage. Ricardo Salinas Pliego, the head of Grupo Salinas and Latin America's seventh richest man, took to Twitter yesterday to confirm his COVID-19 diagnosis and said, quote, everyone will get the infection eventually. London and Paris, meanwhile, clamping down on gatherings. France reporting a record 30,621 new positive test results. FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn says a series of trial stops involving Eli Lilly, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca are all a part of the system to make sure that any COVID-19 vaccine or therapy will ultimately be safe. Dr. William Moss is executive director of the Johns Hopkins International Vaccine Access Center, and on Bloomberg Television this morning, he talked about the coronavirus vaccine development process.
We're looking to compare how many people get COVID in those who get the vaccine and how many people get COVID who don't get the study vaccine. And in a pandemic, because there are a lot of cases, this can happen much more quickly than outside a pandemic. So this whole process of vaccine development can be accelerated and really be done safely as well.
The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Peloton Interactive has been sued for patent infringement by Icon Health and Fitness, that's the maker of the Nordic track bike, escalating the legal tussle between the two fitness equipment giants, shares up by 2.8%. Fiat Chrysler has agreed to invest as much as $1.1 billion in one of its two assembly plants in Canada, all part of a tentative agreement reached with more than 9,000 local auto workers. Fiat Chrysler shares tumbling now by just about 1.4%. Recapping, stocks lower. S&P down now by 10, down 0.3%. I'm Charlie Pellett. That's the Bloomberg Business Flash.
All right, Charlie, appreciate that update. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Paul Sweeney on this Thursday. A lot of headlines when it comes to the virus. We've got more curbs imposed because of COVID over in the UK, France as well. European nations are seeing record increases in new infections. So we're dealing with that. We're also seeing, though, some better news maybe in New York City, a leveling off of infections in some of those hot spots. But that's not the case if you take a look at a city like Houston. They are dealing with some troubling numbers. So let's bring in our own Michelle Cortez, because she is Bloomberg News health science and medical technology reporter. And she joins us on the phone from Minneapolis. Michelle, always good to check in with you and just kind of see where we are. So among the headlines, you know, when it comes to COVID, whether it's the vaccine, treatments, just the rising numbers, and then let's not forget that we're also seeing the Harris campaign specifically now deal with an outbreak. What is it that's catching your attention that you think everybody needs to kind of sit up and take notice about?
The number of infections is on the rise in Europe and some other places. We are hitting record levels for the pandemic. We always did know that this winter was going to be more difficult, but it's not yet winter, right? I mean, we're only the middle of October. So the idea that we are starting to see some really troubling things at a time when we should have learned some of our lessons in terms of how to behave individually to reduce the risk, and that we're seeing it now when there is still the option of, you know, being outside as opposed to inside, keeping your distance, wearing a mask, and we're seeing these rising numbers, I think that's very worrisome.
You know, Michelle, I guess the question is, as I look at those numbers coming out of Europe and other places, again, yes, we did expect some type of second wave. Is it just simply behavior issues, or is there potentially a new virus out there? I mean, a new strain of the virus, or is it just behavior?
So, I mean, that's the terrifying question, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is very, very worrisome. Like, I don't even want you to say that. Like, don't jinx anything, for heaven's sake. But that's the concern. I think that if that was actually happening, we would be seeing even much more dramatic numbers than we're seeing now. And I certainly hope that that's not the case. I have not heard anything about that. So,
fingers crossed.
I hope that. Yeah, fingers crossed. The things to remember is that it's not just our individual behavior. This is a respiratory virus. Respiratory viruses are known to circulate in the colder months. We're coming into the colder months. It also is known to circulate easier in dry, cold air conditions, air conditions, right, where there's less moisture in the air so that the viral particles can spread. They can basically last a little bit longer in the air and go from one person to another. So all of those things are conspiring against us right now. The thing is that it's so early days.
Yeah. Well, listen, Michelle, you know this. You know, you've been reporting for Bloomberg, you know, day in and day out, watching all of the developments. I mean, what are your expectations for as it starts to get even colder here? I mean, it's interesting to see New York kind of leveling off. And I do feel like this is a city that understands, here's what we need to do, folks. And I feel like everybody's getting used to wearing masks and we get it, right? Some of us have been back to work and we understand this social distancing thing and we don't even think twice about it. But I do wonder what your expectations are.
It's really interesting if you look at the numbers. On Bloomberg.com, we have a really great map that you can look at individual states and see what's happening with the trends. And it really seems to me that the states that were hard hit early do seem to have come down and have kept things down. The increasing numbers that we're seeing in the U.S. and perhaps across Europe, there's not as good of of mapping data that I've seen out of there with these kind of great tracking numbers. The places that have just continually risen, you know, certainly we're seeing some of it in the Midwest and the Dakotas, that kind of stuff.
Right.
They're just on an upward trajectory. So they haven't yet basically embraced the suck, so to speak, right?
Like, yep.
You guys know how it's going to be in New York, and
yeah.
you've reined it in. In other places, that's not yet happened. And hopefully we do get there. The other piece of it is that in New York, it was so intense.
Yeah, exactly.
In March and April. Now it seems like it's worse. The numbers are much higher, but it's spread out across an entire country as opposed to, you know, Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed. Everything's crossed right now because we really hope it doesn't go back. Michelle, thank you so much. You're always keeping us up to date and just making us smarter. Michelle Cortez, Bloomberg News health science and medical technology reporter on the phone from Minneapolis.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser on Bloomberg Radio.
This is definitely a true Business Week story about the motorcycle industry, right? Which
this
were, I think most of us, Paul, we would normally think about Harley.
Yeah.
But this one is about an Indian-made motorcycle with a retro look that is coming after Harley big time. So let's get into it with Bloomberg News reporter Ari Alstetter. He's on the phone in Toronto, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber on the line from Massachusetts. This is a really fun story. Interesting story, Paul.
Yes, it is. It's really cool. I'm not a big motorcycle person, but I love just kind of the look and feel of some of those.
All right, Jill.
Yeah, Paul, you are not the target audience.
I know.
Ouch.
That is sort of the point of the story and what Ari came to us with is like, look, like we've written about Harley's predicament before. You know, this is a company that makes, you know, these iconic Americana bikes and has this real dilemma, which is an aging demographic. That's not buying more bikes and probably buying even fewer of them in the years ahead. And Harley specifically has really struggled to sort of tack to a younger audience that's not buying bikes. And that's what caught our attention with Ari's story when he came to us with this pitch about Royal Enfield, which a lot of people might actually remember. Like that was a British bicycle brand once upon a time. And now it's in the motorcycle game. They've got these retro looking really stylish bikes that are about the third of a cost of Harley. They've caught on in India and Southeast Asia, and now they're sort of eyeing this global expansion. And all of those things sort of made us go, huh, there's a story to be told here. Arlie, who's behind this, and what's the vision that they see?
Right. Well, the entrepreneur behind this is a guy named Siddhartha Lal, and he is the third generation scion of this business family based in Delhi. And his father actually bought the Royal Enfield brand, which is it was the Indian unit of what was originally the British motorcycle manufacturer. That was a big deal in British motorcycling around the 1960s. But the British company went under. The Indian one just kept on trucking along until it went into trouble when Siddhartha Lal's father bought it, tried to turn it around, and then Siddhartha took over, and he really turned it into a cool thing for millennials, for young people. He spent the last 20 years retooling the bikes, making them easier to ride, chucking out the old cast iron engine that had been shuddering along on these bikes since the Second World War, putting in a newer aluminum engine that wasn't so prone to breaking down, but keeping the look, that sort of cool post-war Steve McQueen look of the bikes. And, just like millennials everywhere, heritage brands, retro brands really appealed to millennials in India, and they've really taken off.
So, Ari, I'm glad you mentioned Steve McQueen, because when I saw the bike, it just reminded me of that movie, The Great Escape, and you had Steve McQueen riding this bike trying to escape the Germans. It's a really, really cool look here. The price tag also is interesting to me, roughly a third the cost of a Harley-Davidson. So are they really thinking about the U.S. market?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's actually what they expect to be their main selling point in the U.S. market. That, you'll get a bike with character, with heritage. It's all metal. They call it a naked bike. These kind of bikes are called naked bikes because they don't have all the plexiglass or whatever coverings that a Japanese bike like a Kawasaki might have. You just see the steel, the aluminum, you see the motor, you see the gas tank, but you get it for a third of the price of Harley or a third of the price of Indian. And I think that is sort of the advantage they see here. Because they're producing for their home market, India, which is the largest motorcycle market in the world, they're producing at such scale that they can offer these bikes at a lower cost. And the thinking is that, maybe that might be an easier entry point for a cash-strapped millennial who might want to get out of the city on the weekend than a $15,000 Harley.
And the pandemic, certainly, all of us are looking for personal escape pods, I think, Ari. The other thing, though, that you hint at here, which is regardless of sort of how much market share they could potentially acquire in the U.S., even just the fact that Americans would ride a bike made in India will probably be able to like sort of boost the international appeal in places like Southeast Asia. Can you talk more about like what the rationale there is?
And can I just add to that? There's one well-known American, Jay Leno, who already likes it.
Oh,
that's right. Yeah, no, he had the Royal Enfield's two new bikes, the Interceptor and the Continental, on his sort of YouTube show where he reviews automotive products, and he really liked it. And actually, it's an interesting point you bring up, Joel, about the sort of business strategy here, because can Royal Enfield bring motorcycling back to what it was and have millennials riding at the same rate that boomers did? I mean, Royal Enfield would say probably not, or at least we don't know. But they're coming from a baseline of zero in the U.S., a baseline or nearly zero in the U.S., or very low in Europe. And so every one of those bikes, one, for them, that they manage to sell in the U.S. or Europe, it's a very high-margin product for them, so a bit better margins than they're getting in India, so it's helpful from that point of view. But then also, it increases the brand cachet in India. It increases the brand cachet in Thailand or Brazil, because this is a product that suddenly Westerners like. So in Royal Enfield's latest results, they made a point of saying in the last year, one of those new bikes, the Interceptor, was the top-selling middleweight motorcycle in the UK. Now, is that necessarily a lot of motorcycles? Maybe not, but that will really matter to a consumer in India, because suddenly it has this cachet, it has this sign of sort of foreign success around it, and that'll help.
I'm just going to say it is a really fun read, and the story kicks off with talking about this one biker club in India, and like you think bikers, right, Paul? And you think, all right, we're going on a ride, and then we're going to stop at a bar.
Right.
And these guys actually go to a juice factory.
Right.
Where they've got punch, and they've got ice cream sundaes and cocktail liqueurs. So it's a little bit of a different feel, but we talk about disruption, and they definitely, you know, have an opportunity to really change.
And it's been an issue for Harley Davidson to try to attract that younger crowd. They've not been able to do it. They're trying.
Right. And you've got a lot of older folks who are saying, okay, I'm done with my motorcycle riding days.
Yep.
So it really puts a squeeze on them. All right. Great story, of course, from Ari Alstetter. He is reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from Toronto. Check it out at Bloomberg.com. I'll put it out on Twitter as well. And Joel Weber, of course, our editor at Bloomberg Business Week on the remote access from Massachusetts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser on Bloomberg Radio.
All right. Well, the stimulus saga continues. I'm Carol Masser along with Paul Sweeney. You know, Paul, I was just checking on the Bloomberg to see if there's anything new out, because I believe Nancy Pelosi was meeting or at least having another call with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin today. We know the Democrats want a $2.2 trillion plan. The president said, came out, right, and said he would maybe be okay with a plan in excess of $1.8 trillion. I mean, it goes back and forth.
There was a great headline earlier today on the terminal, which captures it all, which is President Trump pushes for stimulus. McConnell says no. And there you go.
Well, that to me is just shocking that the Republicans are pushing back at their own president. You're right. So you're right. It says
it's 2020.
All. It's 2020. It's politics 2020. That's for sure. Well, listen, all of this is happening as the U.S. economy continues to send reminders that all is not well. We talked about that at the top of the show. In today's Business Week Economics, Simona Makuta is senior economist at State Street Global Advisors, joining us on the firm from Massachusetts. The firm, by the way, has over $3 trillion in assets under management. Simona, good to have you here with us. How, as an economist, do you watch these stimulus headlines? How do you kind of work them in, if at all at this point, into your projections about the economy?
Well, the one thing I will say I do, and I would advise others to do as well, is to try not to watch these minute by minute, because things are really changing. And just take a step back and ask two questions. How much stimulus do we need, and how quickly do we need it? And I think on the first question of how much, I would argue that probably we don't need the $2.2 trillion and probably not even the $1.8. And it's true that the economy is not running on all cylinders, but frankly, as I look at where is aid needed most, I would certainly point to the airline sectors before I would point to state and local government, perhaps. So I think there are really things that are more necessary than others and more urgent than others, but not the whole $2 trillion is needed right now.
Unless you're one of those 8 million that have slipped into poverty since May as federal aid has dried up. I mean, for a lot of regular Americans, you know, they're not in the headlines. The airlines may be, and I feel for that industry as well and those workers, but there's a lot of people who are not getting by, and they can't even put food on their table.
That is true, and I think what you're pointing out is exactly the difference in what this new round of stimulus needs to deliver versus what the first round did, which is the first one was, you know, blanket, cover everybody, because you just don't have time to really assess who is in most dire need. I think the point now is that, you know, how can we identify where the need is greatest? And you're right, there are many millions. We have like about 4 million people who are permanently unemployed, no longer even, you know, on the temporarily unemployed. I would argue they are the ones who definitely need help soon, now, versus, you know, does anybody who receives the $1,200 check in the first round, do they still need it today? I mean, it would be nice perhaps to have it, but it's not the same degree of need and urgency. So it's troublesome that we cannot seem to agree and at least sign off on the things that the bits of the stimulus that are most urgently needed, right, even as you try to assess the other parts.
Yeah, it's interesting, Simona. You know, we had another jobless claims number out today, which is something we here at Bloomberg Radio and TV focus on as a, you know, certainly a high frequency data point, and boy, stubbornly high on those jobless claims here. How concerned are you that some of this is, I'm not going to say permanent, but it's this jobless situation here is not something that's going to snap back anytime soon or with any velocity. Are you concerned about that as we go forward?
Of course I'm concerned, and I don't think there is anybody who watches the economy and the labor market who would not, you know, wish for those initial claims to come down much faster.
I mean, the longer they don't come down, I mean, it's more problematic, right, in terms of getting them back to work?
Exactly. But there is also some confusing details on the initial claim. So, I mean, it's increasingly tricky because now you're in this period where some of the benefits are lapsing for the early people who started. So on one hand, you have the initial claims still very high. Continuing claims are declining. But you have to wonder, are they declining because all those people are going back to work, or are they losing benefits? The good thing, and I think the one encouraging thing, is that a lot of the people on furlough previously, you know, they used to be 17 million. Now they're about 6. So we are making progress. But as I've said many times, it's easier to get from 15% unemployment to 8. It will be much harder to get from 8 to 4.
So Simona, that's the consumer side of the equation, the 70% of the economy. Are people back to work? Are they spending money? How about the manufacturing side of the economy? That seems to be seeing some green shoots, if not a little bit more.
Yes, and that's certainly in the data that we got today from the Philly Fed. I would say that's one sector where I look for continued momentum and improvement. In a way, it's tricky. It's funny to say, but if you look at the retail sales relative to where you are at the beginning of the year, you've made the full recovery. Industrial production has not yet, but I think there is more solid momentum in the pipeline there for additional gains. And you've seen that in the new orders, you've seen it in shipments. And the way I think about it, the earlier gains in industrial production, not just in the States, but elsewhere, have really been the result of that particular economy reopening. Now I think you're increasingly starting to get the benefits of the global supply chain coming back fully, or as close to full as possible. So I think the manufacturing sector is actually in a better shape going into the next 3-4 months. There's an inventory cycle that also will propel manufacturing production.
Simona, just got 30 seconds here. I mean, what is it that worries you most about the economy right now and that we may not be spending enough time on, and that may be the story of 2021? Just quickly.
I think the people who are falling under the radar, as you've mentioned, it's hard to count, right? I think it's those most vulnerable people that are difficult to identify in statistics. And how do you reach them? Going forward, I worry that at some point, even if this round of stimulus eventually will come, but what happens after that, right? At some point, the stimulus has to be reined in, and will the economy be able to fully compensate?
Yeah, we need to think about that and certainly have the plans in place. Simona, thank you so much. Simona Makuta, she is senior economist at State Street Global Advisors, joining us on the phone from Massachusetts. And Paul, constantly that disconnect between kind of Wall Street and Main Street, right?
Absolutely.
That we continue to see. I'm driving in my car.
I turn on the radio. How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. Who's gonna drive you home? Honey, please, I'll do the driving. Drive
on. Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us. Drive away, take a break. We can
reach our destination. This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, it is time for the Drive to the Close, and back with us is someone who is certainly familiar to our audiences. We're talking about Walter Todd, Chief Investment Officer at Greenwood Capital Associates, on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina. And Walter, it's good to have you back. I think we last talked in mid-July. How are you doing? How's South Carolina?
Hey, Carol. Good afternoon. We're doing okay. We've got, like a lot of places, cases picking up a little bit here recently. And my son Blake was diagnosed a little while back, but is fully recovered and
he's
back to college. So all good.
Yeah, that's the folks went back to college here. A lot of those kinds of stories. I have two in college myself at big colleges, so you just keep your fingers crossed there. Walter, it's also a big political day here today. Lots of news on the political front. We've got a couple of dueling town halls tonight from the two candidates. How are you telling your investors to kind of think about the election pre-post as they think about their portfolios?
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer. A lot of people are worked up about this election for a variety of different reasons, depending on which side you're coming from. But for us, I think the message is kind of hold the course here. You've seen the market kind of rally over the last 2 weeks in anticipation of maybe a more decisive election outcome. I think the concern a month ago was we might have a contested election. Doesn't seem to be the case at this point, but of course, two to three weeks to go, so anything can happen. So I think the big changes people like to talk about are really unlikely, regardless of the outcome, because it really goes down to the Senate and who controls that. And the reality is, the control either way is going to be one or two seats, and so there's not going to be the flexibility to do a lot of dramatic changes. There will certainly be policy differences between the two administrations for sure. But as far as making any big moves ahead of the election, we would not kind of advise that.
So I do wonder, too, our team over on Bloomberg TV caught up with the Morgan Stanley CFO, Jonathan, I think Prusin, hopefully I'm saying it correctly. But he said a blue wave is priced into the market already. And so he said, judging by the market moves in the lead up to the vote, investors don't seem too spooked by the possibility. Are you in that camp? Do you kind of agree with that?
It seems to be, when you look at the performance, what's performed really over the past month as the polls have widened out, it certainly seems to reflect that. So you look at alternative energy, for example, has dramatically outperformed. Banks have underperformed, which would do better under a Republican regime. So when you look at kind of and parse it out and what's worked and what hasn't worked, it definitely seems to be pricing in more of a blue wave outcome at this point.
Walter, one of the things that we've all observed in the market recently is this kind of this push and pull between, the folks saying, I'm just going to stick with my big cap leverage, big cap tech names that have worked so well for me. They've got great top line growth stories. I don't have to worry about too much because the growth is already there, whether it's an Amazon or an Apple. And the others are saying, hey, at some point we got to look to the other side of this pandemic. There will be economic expansion. I need to now begin to think about rotating into some of those more cyclical sectors. Where do you kind of fall out in that discussion?
Yeah, it's a great question. And just to kind of tie back into what Dave Wilson was talking about before I came on, kind of that growth versus value discussion, it's really a sector debate, right? And when you look at the Russell 1000 growth, it's a highly concentrated index. 20% of the index is in Apple and Microsoft. 63% of that index is in technology, communication services, and Amazon. So, yes, those have been the best performers. I think you want to continue to have exposure to those secular winners, but to your point, I do think you want to have a barbell approach and have some exposure to areas that are going to benefit from a normalization of the economy and continued reopening of the economy. It may be lumpy, as we know we might get more cases here in the winter, but you can look at that in all different sectors, not just what you think of as deep cyclicals like energy and materials, for example, but even in like healthcare, you can look at healthcare equipment names that have been hurt by the slowdown in elective surgeries, for example. They would benefit as that starts to normalize, for example. So I think there are a lot of areas outside of those headline-grabbing big-cap tech names that are opportunities.
I do wonder, too, in terms of pent-up demand. I mean, obviously, you can't go and take a vacation that you couldn't take earlier this year. You can't retake that in 2021. You certainly can take one, but you can't kind of add to what was lost. So I do wonder, what will be the pent-up demand stories and cases that ultimately provide some investment opportunities, Walter, for individuals?
Yeah, well, we've seen some of that manifest itself, for example, in RVs right now.
Yeah.
People going camping and boats and so forth. But,
but that's substitution, right? It'll be interesting to see if it continues next year.
If you look at it a little bit further, hotels would probably be drivable hotels. So, the ones that are closer to home, not in the big cities like Marriott, maybe like an extended stay or something of that nature. plane or airlines, for example, I think are starting to see some of that, but they really are so reliant on that business travel, which United Airlines CEO said today he didn't see that normalize until 2024.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, which is amazing to think about. And so I do think some of those industries are going to really take some time to come back. But I would say probably hospitality is maybe one of those areas that you could see a catch-up trade in.
Hey, Walter, as you talk to your clients, what's the vibe you're getting for them? Are they really shook up and say, I really want to pull in the reins here on terms of risk? Or are they saying, I get this. This is bad, but it's temporary, and I can look to the other side. What's the kind of the feedback?
Yeah, so clients are really nervous about this election and the outcome and the impact to the market. So we're having a lot of conversations with clients about that. Beyond that, it's really talking about asset allocation, which is very difficult right now, given that the 10-year treasury notes at 0.6%. How do you asset allocate? You know, traditional 60-40 is more challenging, so you got to get more creative when you're talking to clients about that. So those are a lot of discussions that we're having right now. But I would say, in general, clients beyond the election outcome are generally feeling okay.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Hey, Walter, nice to check in with you. Walter Todd, he is Chief Investment Officer at Greenwood Capital Associates, joining us on the phone from Greenwood, South Carolina.
Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or at Bloomberg.com. And be sure to check out our daily radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio. And be sure to watch us, too, on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.